Hello and welcome to Provox, a podcast from the Queen's College, Oxford. I'm delighted to be joined by one of our, I think, most distinguished fellows, Professor Jane Langdale, who's Professor of Plant Development here at the University of Oxford and a long-term fellow of the Queen's College. So you've done a lot of incredibly important research in plant science, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But it'll be good to start at the beginning, as I'm doing with all of these podcasts. Just tell us a little bit how did you get into biology? Why are you a biologist?
School teacher. I think it's the same story for most people. My biology teacher at school was the one who enthused me most. End of story. So I went off and did biology at university. I didn't start with plant biology. I started with microbiology, and I did PhD in human genetics. Mm-hmm. And then I switched to plants. I sort of worked through.
So it can't just have been the teacher. You obviously then enjoyed your university degree in biology enough to go and do a PhD and so on. So there was something about the subject that grabbed you as well.
There is, but I did a sandwich course when I was at university. So I was at Bath, which meant we had 6 months of lectures, which were pretty dull. And then we had 6 months where we went out into the real world and worked in labs. And I had the good fortune to work at the Imperial Cancer Research Fund, which was one of the leading research centres in the UK at the time. And then the following year, I went to Cold Spring Harbour, which was a real game changer for me. Cold Spring Harbour is an institute in Long Island, in New York, and it's a very well-known institute for biological research. And there was a lot happening at the time in the early 80s in terms of the revolution of molecular biology. And I was just there in the lab as it was happening, and that's what really...
What sort of things were you doing?
I was actually discovering what's known as restriction enzymes that cut bits of DNA, which we use all the time now to actually manipulate pieces of DNA and clone DNA. And at the time, it was revolutionary. Mm-hmm. And DNA sequencing was just being taken up in labs, so I was doing that as well. So it just felt I was really at the cutting edge. And that's what I enjoyed the lab work.
Yeah, well I think that's the sort of thing that puts some people off going on and doing a PhD in research, but I obviously enjoyed it. But you started off with human genetics.
Yep.
But then moved on to plants. I mean, for a layman, that feels like a big change, but I suspect you're going to say it's all at the molecular level, so maybe not such a big change.
It is all at the molecular level, so it's not a big change. And in fact, the timing was fantastic because the human genetics field was much more advanced. That's where most of the techniques were being developed. And so when I came into plant biology, I was able to apply those approaches and do things that people in the plant biology field said, oh, we can't do that in plants. Like, yes, you can. Of course you can.
Okay.
And of course, the biggest difference moving from human genetics to plant genetics is you can do crosses. And if you're a geneticist,
you want to do crosses. So explain what a cross is.
Basically, you take one plant, cross it to the other, and get progeny. And so in my case, I was working with maize, has male and female inflorescences. And so you take the pollen from the male and you put it on the female, and you collect the kernels and you plant them out, and that's the progeny.
Right. So in what sense is that a cross? Because you're doing it between different species of maize or something?
No, you can do it just between different individuals.
Right.
So you just cross two individuals with different traits, and then you see how they segregate in the progeny. Mm-hmm. So I was interested in the time at looking at mutations that influenced leaf development. So I'd take one mutant with a particular leaf phenotype and cross it to another, and then see when you brought those two traits together, whether it made them better or worse or different.
Better and worse in what sense?
Well, in that sense, I was looking at chloroplast development, so how plants photosynthesize. So if it got worse, they got very sick. They went from pale green to yellow to white to dead.
So is this telling us something about how these plants have evolved, or is this something a bit different to that?
No, it's a bit, this was very much, the genetics was at that point was very much looking at how they develop. So at that time, at the beginning, I was looking at how chloroplasts develop. So if you don't get chloroplasts in a plant, they will not photosynthesize, they will not survive. So how do you get a chloroplast? How does it go from being a small proplastid, as it's called, in the seed, which doesn't do anything as the seed germinates, the chloroplasts have to develop, they have to start harvesting light, they have to start photosynthesizing to produce sugars to make the plants grow. And so that was a developmental process that I was interested in, because the chloroplast has its own genome. The origins of the chloroplasts are actually in cyanobacteria, but it's actually the plant nuclear genome that controls most of how the chloroplast develops. And so it was trying to understand what genes in the plant nucleus enabled the chloroplast to develop so that the plant could photosynthesize.
I'm nodding wisely, but I'm not sure I quite understand what it means to say that the chloroplast has its own genome.
So it has its own DNA that encodes for some of the proteins that accumulate in the chloroplast. It's the same with mitochondria, so that's the same in us as well.
Yeah,
our mitochondria
right,
have their own genome. Some of the proteins in the organelles are produced by the organella genome, but through evolution, the host, the eukaryotic host, so us or the plant, has taken control of that organelle. So some of the proteins are made by the eukaryotic nucleus, and some are made by the organelle. And in many cases, you get enzymes, for example, that have subunits encoded partly by the organelle and partly by the host nucleus. And so
in a sense, this is
a control.
I'm trying to understand this. Tiny other animals, as it were, that have become part of us or become part of the plant. So it's probably an
absurd bacteria.
Way, again,
they were bacteria.
The bacteria have become part
of every cell.
And the chloroplasts are part of the plant cells, and
yes,
our mitochondria are part of ours, but they started off as bacteria.
Yes.
Okay, I'm learning lots.
So the endosymbiotic theory is the theory that essentially eukaryotic cells evolved by engulfing organelles or bacteria that became mitochondria and chloroplasts. So plants have mitochondria and chloroplasts in their cells, and we don't have the chloroplasts.
Okay.
We're inferior in that respect.
in many other respects too, I'm sure. So essentially your research, and I guess this is what you've been doing for a long time now, is effectively looking at how leaves develop and how they've evolved. I guess this is obvious in a sense, but just tell us why that matters.
Well, it matters to me because I'm curious.
But does it matter to me?
I could persuade you that it should matter
to
you. But let's start at the sort of fundamental bit. So I'm interested in patterns. How is patterns formed during development in any organism? Now you see those wonderful shells that have like musical scores on them. That's a developmental pattern that somehow is regulated by the organism. So I'm interested in patterns in grass leaves. So if you look at a grass leaf, you look at it and you think it's long and thin, and they all look the same, right?
It's about as far as I've ever got, I have to
say. It's like they all look the same. They're really dull. It doesn't matter whether you're looking at grass in your lawn or whether you're looking at a maize plant or a rice plant. They've all got long, strap-shaped leaves. But if you take a cross-section through those leaves, there's two very distinct patterns within those leaves. And one of the patterns is typical of what's known as C3 grasses. So they're the ones that photosynthesize by taking carbon dioxide and fixing it into a 3-carbon compound. And that pattern is essentially you have a vein, and then you have, so we're looking in cross-section there, we've cut this leaf like that, and we're looking down that way. And you have a vein, and then you have about 10 cells, all of which have chloroplasts in them that photosynthesize, and you have another vein. If you look in a C4 grass, so something like maize or sorghum, you have a vein, you have some photosynthetic cells around it, and then you just have 2 cells, and then you have the same again. Those photosynthetic cells in another vein. So you have these repeating units that go all the way across the leaf. And that, how that pattern develops is what's intrigued me for many years, and I don't know the answer still.
Okay.
I know how the chloroplasts develop now in those cells, so we did that, but we don't know how you get the veins occurring at closer intervals in the leaf. And the reason that's important is because when the veins are closer together, you have one of these cells surrounding the veins and one of the cells in between the veins that work together in photosynthesis, and they shuttle metabolites between the two, and that photosynthesis is much more efficient than the regular C3.
Okay.
So this C4 photosynthesis evolved. Okay. It evolved about 60 times independently all about 30 million years ago. It's way more efficient. It uses less nitrogen, and it uses less water. So if we understood.
And this is only in some kinds of grasses, or more wide in the plant kingdom.
There is more wider in the plant kingdom,
but still a small minority.
Still a small minority, yes. So for me, that anatomical pattern has—I've always been very curious about it. So coming back then to how can I persuade you that it was interesting to know?
You're getting there.
A consortium of groups from across the world started what we call the C4 Rice Project back in 2008 now. And the goal of that was to try and convert rice, which is C3, into a C4 photosynthesizing plant. Mm-hmm. And it was modeled that if we could do that, we could increase yield by 50%, reduce water use by about 50%, and reduce the application of nitrogen fertilizer. So win, win, win.
Yep.
And we thought, well, this has happened 60 times independently during evolution, switch from C3 to C4, how difficult could it be?
Quite difficult, I'm guessing.
So we embarked on this global consortium project backed by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation back in 2008. And essentially what we had to do was work out how to change the leaf anatomy and then how to make two cells photosynthesize together rather than just the single cell that photosynthesizes in C3, which wasn't very straightforward, isn't very straightforward.
So you've been at this for nearly 20 years now.
Yeah.
How's it going?
Well, it's coming to an end, but we don't have a product.
Right.
It is coming to an end in as much as we have done as much as we can at this point with current technology to show that it will be possible. So there are three things you have to do to convert C3 to C4. One is you've got to change how the veins are spaced in the leaf, and that's the bit that my group's been working on. The other is you have to get chloroplast developing in those cells around the veins, because in C3 plants they don't photosynthesize, but in C4 they very much do. And the other is you have to get the enzymes that are involved in shuttling these metabolites backwards and forwards. So where are we? We have generated a rice plant with enzymes that we took from a C4 plant, from maize. So we've put those enzymes in, just into the regular rice leaf anatomy. And we have shown that we have got flux through those enzymes in the rice plant. It's very, very low, because if you can imagine, I said at the beginning, you've got two veins like this and you've got rows of about 10 cells doing photosynthesis. Well, if we're trying to get pairs of cells around the veins doing it, the best we're going to get is little hubs of C4 activity here, and the rest of the leaf's going to be doing C3. So actually it was very difficult to detect the activity, but we have detected it. It's about 2% of what you see in a C4 plant, but the enzymes are working and we can detect the individual steps of the pathway. So tick, however, it's kind of pointless to continue doing that now. We've shown we can do it, but we need to get the anatomy changed in order to properly see what flux we can get through those enzymes. We have induced chloroplast development in the cells around the veins, and we've done that to the same extent as you see in a C4 plant. Mm-hmm. And the good thing about that is that even though those plants are still doing C3 photosynthesis, they're much more efficient because they've got more cells doing it. So we've actually got some of those out in the field at the moment doing field trials to see how much more productive those plants might be on their own, even though they're not C4.
And you think there might be, what, several percentage points?
Yeah, I think the initial trials show about 10%.
That's not bad.
It's not bad, but the particular lines we've got are in our sort of what we call our experimental workhorse line, which has never been bred as an elite variety. So it's got a lot of headspace to improve anyway. Okay. So we're just now regenerating those lines in elite varieties to redo those.
By elite varieties, you mean the most productive ones that, rices?
Yeah, the ones that are used by, to grow food.
Okay.
So the veins, the bit that I'm responsible for, I will say we knew nothing about it 20 years ago, whereas we knew all the genes that encoded the C4 enzymes. We knew nothing. We still don't know exactly how those veins are spaced. We're still looking. We're still working at it. I'm still curious. What we have done is managed to convert some of the small veins in the leaf into bigger veins. So we've increased the volume of veins on a leaf area. and we've increased the number of cells around those veins because they're bigger. So we've got more of these photosynthesizing cells, but we're not there yet. And that's the one bit where there still needs to be a lot of discovery science.
And is the difficulty you're facing doing this part of an explanation, or is it completely separate from why more plants haven't evolved? I mean, this is so much more efficient. Why hasn't evolution resulted in more plants doing this?
That's a very good question, because there's a cost. It uses more energy. And so it's only profitable to the plant if it's in hot, dry conditions. So if in a temperate environment,
right,
it isn't beneficial. So, you know, people sometimes ask me, well, why didn't you try and do C4 wheat? Mm-hmm. Well, partly because the benefits are not likely to be as great in temperate crops as they are in tropical crops. So that's why we chose rice.
Right.
But also wheat's what's known as a hexaploid. It's got 6 copies of its genome, whereas rice is a diploid, so it's got 2 copies.
So it's easier to work with.
It's easier to work with. If you're going to try and mess with something, then and the genome's always going to be fighting back, then try it with something with 2 copies, not with 6.
Kind of makes sense. So you said there's a lot more discovery science to do. I mean, you think we'll get there?
I think so, and I'm still writing grants to do that out with the C4 Rice Project. But I think what I've realised over the years is, you know, the fact that grass leaves never vary in shape. So any other plant, if you go and look at a shrub in your garden, you'll probably find 1 or 2 leaves on it that are just odd shapes. They haven't developed normally. You don't see that with grasses.
Okay.
Everything's very uniform. And even though the vein patterns are different between C4 and C3 grasses, there's still a great degree of regularity within the individual species. So in rice, you always get 8 or 9 cells between the veins, and in maize, you always get 2. And even though we've tried to mutate those and disrupt it, we never really have managed to do it. So you can't alter the shape and you can't alter the spacing between the veins within any particular species, which says to me that there's some sort of self-regulating process that you push a button, it'll push back. That some mechanism. So I am starting to doubt. I think we'll understand that mechanism, but I'm starting to doubt whether we'll be able to perturb it to the extent that we need to, because unless we can really uncouple what it is that is doing the checks and balances across the whole leaf.
Okay.
So, I need to work with mathematical modellers now.
Right. Well, the good thing about a university like Oxford is there'll be a few of those around.
Indeed.
Just give us a sense of, how many people have you got in your lab working on this? You said it's an international collaboration. I mean, what is the scale of this research?
So now it's probably, I mean, as I say, we're sort of winding down. I've got 6 people in my lab at the moment. At peak, I had about 12.
Right. So all working on this project.
Yeah, all working on the vein part of it. Mm. The consortium as a whole, at one point we had groups in 10 or 11 different countries. And there were, so we sort of split into teams. We had metabolism teams working on the enzymes, and we had chloroplast teams, and we had anatomy teams and tool developers. Mm-hmm. I mean, every time we developed a new method, we'd do it and then realize we needed to do something else, tweak it a bit more. So we were constantly developing new methods to sort of get things done faster. And
these methods, like actually engineering methods, as it were.
Yeah, biological engineering methods.
Yeah.
So we were going as fast, I mean, we're always going as fast as we can, but we're always limited by the life cycle of the plant.
So these are substantial teams working with, you know, really frontier technology to do this kind of work. And the sort of, that's a lot of resource going in, but the potential gains would be enormous if this could happen.
Yes, it could. And, you know, at one point we had a very active sort of IP strategy, thinking, you know, if we develop certain things, then we could license them to seed companies. Although our project has always been funded by the Gates Foundation, so it's always been global access. Was essentially, we had to enable smallholder farmers to use any product at cost.
Okay. Yeah.
But the idea was, well, maybe we could, you know, get a few things where we'd develop new technologies that companies might be interested in. We could patent those, license them, get a bit of money to go back in the project. It became very clear about 5 or 6 years ago that GM rice was never going to be taken up by any of the companies. I think a lot of it's on the back of the golden rice debacle, which essentially, you know, still it's having problems.
And tell us about the golden rice debacle.
So golden rice has two genes in it that it produce vitamin A in rice. So it was developed back in the late 80s for public good to essentially be a food to prevent vitamin A deficient blindness. And it went through all sorts of regulatory hurdles because it was GM. It finally got accepted in the Philippines to grow. It was sold, or not, it wasn't even sold, it was given to people in that first year. And then there was a court case that closed down the production again. So it's still not out there. And we are, you know, nearly 40 years later.
That must be mind-bogglingly frustrating.
Yes, yes.
I was going to ask you about this whole issue about acceptability of GM foods. I mean, where is the... I didn't know that about the golden rice. I mean, and it's closed down because...
So it's still sort of... it's NGOs battling the whole concept. You know, the fact that it does have a health benefit doesn't seem to matter into...
And is there any scientific basis for their position?
No, not in my view, no. So, you know, the idea that some of the transgenic lines we've been making have got 15, 16 genes in them. So this is one of the reasons we're pausing now, is because what's changed is the whole landscape of how we actually edit genes in plants. So now, instead of introducing new genes, we're developing techniques, that's the global plant science community, to edit endogenous genes. So we have thus far been introducing enzymes from maize into rice. There are equivalents of those enzymes in rice and encoded by the rice genome, but they're just not regulated in the same way. And so I think what the future looks like is that methods will be developed to manipulate the endogenous genes, which is what will have happened in evolution, right? It's not like suddenly a whole bunch of genes came in from another species. Yeah. Things were tweaked in the plant. And so the gene editing, even in the UK, the Precision Breeding Act has said that we can now grow gene-edited plants in this country.
And are we not allowed to grow GM plants?
No. We can do GM trials, experimental trials, but the paperwork and getting it through is very demanding, whereas gene editing is not.
You've obviously got used to this. I'm sitting here slightly horrified by this. I didn't quite realise that we were still that far back.
Yes, and the EU's even further back.
All right, so this is a Brexit benefit.
The Precision Breeding Act was a Brexit benefit. They're few and far between. but of course, you know, you can't work in isolation in these things. You can when you're doing experimental research. But if the UK suddenly says, right, we've got this fantastic wheat variety that has been gene edited, it's totally resistant to every disease that, you know, attacks wheat. So we'll grow it in the UK, but we can't sell it to Europe because they won't have it.
So
we can't be in isolation in these things. And, you know, the EU is coming slowly along.
Is the US further forward on this?
Oh, yeah, the US grows GM crops all the time. Right. Has done for decades.
And do we eat them over here? Do they get exported to us?
They don't get exported as human food, right, but they do come in as animal food, and then we eat the animals. And if you get on a plane in New York and fly here, you will undoubtedly have GM food on your tray in the airplane.
And presumably there's nothing to suggest that this causes any problems.
No.
And without sort of going into this, is there no reason behind any of this? Is it just a kind of fear?
I think a lot of it is, it's anti-big business.
Mm-hmm.
you know, a lot of the early products were things like Roundup Ready Corn, which basically says you can plant out your corn and you can spray your whole field with Roundup, which will kill all the weeds, but it won't kill the corn.
Right, okay.
So it was seen as something that made the seed companies a lot of money, it made the farmers a lot of money, but it wasn't actually very beneficial to the consumer. And so I think a lot of the, you know, it's the anti-Monsanto sentiment. But that's no different than pharma.
Well, indeed. I mean, we wouldn't have all of our drugs that keep us alive if we didn't have businesses actually doing that.
And you wouldn't get ill if you couldn't eat.
Yeah.
Because you wouldn't get old enough to get sick.
I mean, are there? I mean, you're obviously working on your particular developments, which you know you've not got there yet. But are there technologies that do now exist that could be used across the world that are not being used and which would stave off a lot of hunger?
I think there's a lot of. I mean, there's. Iron-enriched rice is just coming on to the market. There are purple tomatoes that are coming online that are very good for you, antioxidants. Mm-hmm. They were developed by Kathy Martin in the John Innes Institute. They are GM. Mm-hmm. And they can be grown in Canada and juiced in Canada, and the juice can be sold. We can't grow them here at the moment, but they are applying for regulatory approval for those. So there's various things that are coming through. There's canola that makes omega-3 fish oils, developed in this country. And it was GM, but now there's a gene-edited version that will probably come online at some point because feeding fish farms is not sustainable. So if you could make the omega-3s that the fish need to eat in plants, you could have sustainable fish farming. So there's a number of clever things that are coming along, but they've been going for so long, decades, like 20 years from first idea to even a hint at being deregulated and allowed to be grown.
Right, so 20 years from actually being able to do it to being allowed, so being able to do it, 20 years before you're allowed to do it. Stepping back, you've been doing this for quite some time. I mean, you're obviously, you know, a leader in your field. I mean, you're a fellow of the Royal Society. You've been awarded the CBE. I mean, so this is something that is recognised somewhere in the upper echelons of the world.
By somebody.
By somebody. Do you feel that the sort of wider public has got much idea about this? Is there more that you or others could do to keep us engaged, maybe to make that case for what you're doing?
I think there's always more that can be done. I think part of, and the issue is doing it well. I think part of the reason things went wrong in the 1980s was because the way that the scientists went about advocating for it almost immediately antagonized the public.
So what did they do wrong?
I think primarily treated the public as though they were ignorant, as opposed to, you know, explaining properly what was going on. Having said that, the NGOs had an enormous amount of money behind them. Mm-hmm. Their campaigns were always going to be more effective and reach more people. They put, you know, hundreds of thousands into their anti-GM campaigns. So, you know, poor scientist on the street didn't have much chance.
The NGOs would say there are these big companies that have got billions behind them.
Yeah, but that doesn't help. The big companies saying this is a good wasn't helping at all at the time. Monsanto was the devil. So trying to find that route through that was independent of the companies and the NGOs and still having a big enough voice was very difficult at the time. And a few players took on the job of doing it and it just didn't work. It just didn't work. I think these days, we're a lot more sort of working behind the scenes, making less of a splash about. I mean, there were a lot of us involved with discussions with DEFRA and other government organisations in the Precision Breeding Act.
And when was that?
It was a couple of years ago now that it went through. There's still implementation steps to be done with that. And the House of Lords were involved a lot with that, and made sure there were one or two people in the House of Lords who made sure that they were properly briefed on what the issues were on both sides of the argument.
But it was all quite low profile. I mean, it passed me by entirely, I have to say.
Yeah, but I think that's probably good
in
a way, because it says people are not getting excited about it now. It's just, in fact, ironically, people got more, you may have seen the headlines about precision bred animals as opposed to precision bred plants, because that got more, that rattled more cages.
Right.
But in fact, if we can get animals that are resistant to some of the disease, avian flu or swine flu or whatever, that can't be a bad thing either, right?
Well, you wouldn't think so. And I guess the danger of it being below the rate. I guess I hadn't realised that GM was still sort of a no-no in the way that it clearly is, because it has been below the radar for so long. I remember the debates in the 1980s. I seem to remember going to some public meeting about it and not understanding what was going on, but knowing there were a lot of people very much up in arms about this. But it's but that's almost been enough for decades of delay.
Yeah, but if you go into supermarkets now, you'll still see a lot of products labelled GM-free in big letters.
Yeah, but from what you're saying, they pretty much all have to be anyway. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, okay. So what next for you? I mean, you're going to carry on. I mean, despite the fact that you're reaching this university, if I'm allowed to say this publicly, the point at which most academics are sort of forcibly retired, but they're letting you carry on.
I can carry on as long as I can continue to get funding for my research, and I will try to do that. I've always said that as soon as I am no longer able to get funding for my research, I will quit. Mm. I will go off and do something else. And I've been fortunate that I have managed to keep the funding coming in.
And for most scientists here, I mean, scientists at your level, I mean, most of what they're doing is externally funded like that anyway, is it? Or is that, that's my impression.
Yeah, I mean, we spend our lives writing grants.
Yeah, I mean, I'm used to that in my previous life, where we were entirely funded in that way. And it keeps you honest.
Yeah, it does. And, you also have to, I mean, I've always kept track of the number of grants I apply for and the number of and I average about 10% success rate. And when you say this to
10%,
10%.
Oh God, that's hard.
Well, that's just the way it is.
Yeah.
And so
really have to have some
you
some
have to
real
just keep going
staying
at it.
Power to to go when you're only winning 1 in 10.
Yeah. And you have to have lots of ideas, because they don't like seeing the same ones again. If they've said no once, they don't like to see it again.
I mean, how many funding, there are not that many different funding bodies you can go to either.
No, especially not for plant science research. I mean, I've been very fortunate to be funded by Gates for as long as I have been funded. But I've, at the same time, I've also had BBSRC funding in parallel and ERC funding. And that's the world we live in. It's not going to get any easier.
But is it not getting easier? Maybe not getting easier, but I mean, it's in one sense. I mean, I a lot of academics I talk to, say this that things are getting hard. But the amount of money going into research has been fairly well protected over the last 15, 20 years compared with lots of other bits of public spending.
It has, but what's happened in the background is that the overheads that go to the university as opposed to the research project have been massively increasing.
Okay, so
hugely increasing.
A bit of washing of dirty laundry. And what would you say to young people maybe finishing their degrees in biology? I mean, what's the life of a new researcher in plant science in biology nowadays?
If they're curious and they're genuinely interested in the research they're doing, it's a fantastic career. And certainly, once you get to a point like I'm at now, I couldn't imagine having a better career. Mm. I'm in charge of my own diary. Mm. I get to do what I enjoy doing. Mm. I work with really good people. I still work with young people as well as older people.
Yeah.
I get to do a lot of work for external organisations, but I can pick and choose which of those.
To external organisations meaning?
Well, Royal Society, National
right.
Academy.
Okay.
I do a lot of evaluation boards for yeah. things like the Max Planck Institutes, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of stuff.
There's a lot of exciting stuff when lots of senior academics like this, they're really expert in what they're doing. They work with lots of really keen, clever young people, yeah. and they're using their expertise to input into things around the world, actually, but certainly across the UK.
Yeah, I mean, it's the young people that keep the projects going. I mean, yeah. I have not single-handedly kept my research going for the last 30 years. The people who work with me have. The day you become a research group leader, you're only ever as good as the people who work
absolutely.
With you.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And so they are the people who get you these accolades that you keep saying, mentioning, that it's not me, it's the people who've worked with me.
No, well, I mean, we all know that yeah. My previous career, all of my young colleagues at the Institute for Fiscal Studies, absolutely wonderful, and that gives the institution and the outputs what they are, and exactly the same in a lab. So, you're making a pretty good case for this being a great career still for people who are really keen to work in this kind of area, whatever it is that really excites them.
Yes. But you have to be curious.
You have to be curious, no,
yeah.
absolutely.
Because the things pushing back at you, the 90% rejection of your grants and things,
yeah.
you've got to have something that will override that to give you the resilience to keep going.
Fantastic. I think that's probably a great place to end. Absolutely fascinating conversation. I've learned loads, and we're very much focused on your particular area, and we could have talked a lot more, I'm sure, about plant biology more generally, but I think that's been a wonderful conversation, and actually really, apart from the incredible frustration about the bureaucracy around it, which I absolutely understand, the scope for future development and exciting research is just enormous. So thank you very much.
Thank you.